Imagine living in a country with zero personal income tax. Like your salary is just yours.
Yeah, your capital gains are yours, your local dividends are yours. It's incredible.
Right. It is an environment that is just, custom built for wealth generation. But then somehow you look at your global investment portfolio at the end of the year.
And you realize you are quietly losing, what, up to 30%?
Exactly. Up to 30% of your dividend returns are just gone, eaten by invisible foreign taxes.
Yeah, it's rough.
You are essentially pouring water into a bucket with a massive hole in the bottom. And that completely undermines the very foundation of long-term wealth building. So today, we are figuring out how to plug that leak.
And that dynamic is honestly one of the most misunderstood aspects of modern wealth accumulation. I mean, we spend so much energy trying to pick the perfect asset,
Okay,
right?
well.
But we completely ignore the structural friction, the taxes, the volatility, the behavioral mistakes, and that is what actually destroys your returns over time.
Which makes today's source material incredibly timely for you listening. We are doing a deep dive into a comprehensive guide from the Osul Gamma Investment Platform.
Right.
It's titled Strategic Long-Term Investment Growth in Saudi Arabia. And our mission today is to really decode the exact mechanics of long-term investing.
Specifically, looking at how Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 transformation is creating this totally unique economic ecosystem.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we get into the specific assets or, geographical strategies, the source draws a very hard line in the sand regarding time.
Yeah, they do.
They define a long-term investment strictly as 5 years or more.
Right. And that 5-year mark, it isn't just some arbitrary number they picked out of a hat.
No.
No, it is the statistical threshold where you basically stop trying to predict the weather and you start operating within the broader climate.
Oh, I like that way of framing it.
Yeah. And the source breaks down 4 pillars of long-term investing, but the most critical one is mitigating volatility risk.
Because the short-term swings are just brutal.
Exactly. If you look at any market over, say, a 6-month period, the swings are violent. It is entirely driven by news cycles, earnings misses, geopolitical panic.
Right.
But when you zoom out to a 5 or 10 year horizon, time literally acts as a shock absorber. The fundamental value of the underlying assets takes over, and all that daily noise just gets smoothed out.
Makes sense. And that leads directly into the other pillars they mentioned, right? Like peace of mind.
Yeah.
Because you finally stop frantically checking your phone every time the market opens.
Which is a huge relief.
And then there's the sheer mathematical force of compound growth.
Yeah.
Now, look, if you are listening to this, you probably know what compounding is. It's earning returns on your returns.
Right.
But the source material places compounding in the specific context of the Saudi tax environment.
Yeah.
And that changes the math entirely.
It really does. If we connect this to the bigger picture, compounding is basically just momentum. In a heavily taxed Western economy, every single time an asset pays a dividend, or every time a portfolio is rebalanced and capital gains are realized, the tax authority steps in and takes a slice.
So they're constantly slowing you down.
Exactly. That friction slows the momentum. But in an environment with no personal income tax or capital gains tax, that momentum is completely unobstructed.
So 100% of the return is reinvested.
Yes. And over a 20-year horizon, the difference between an unobstructed compounding curve and a taxed compounding curve is just, I mean, it's staggering. It is the difference between linear growth and exponential wealth generation.
I think we need a visual for this to really make it click. Let's think of your portfolio as an orchard.
Okay, an orchard.
Short-term trading is like trying to catch falling leaves in the wind.
Yeah.
You run around, you exhaust yourself, you might grab one or two, but the wind is totally unpredictable.
Right.
Long-term investing is planting the orchard. You don't stand in the dirt yelling at a little sapling to grow faster.
No, that would be crazy.
You water it, you give it time, and eventually the tree drops more fruit than you could ever possibly catch. The difference with the Saudi environment is that you aren't paying a daily toll on the water or the sunlight.
I love that. That orchard analogy works perfectly because the effort required to chase leaves is frantic, right? But the effort required to tend an orchard is methodical.
Yeah.
It requires a different temperament entirely.
So let's talk about the soil we are planting in today. The source material focuses heavily on the Saudi Arabian landscape, specifically the government's massive push to diversify the economy away from oil.
Right, Vision 2030.
Exactly. And the foundation of this new economy, like the deep soil of our orchard, it seems to be real estate.
Yeah.
But it's not just residential housing. The text points directly to the giga projects. NOM, Roshan, Kudia.
What's fascinating here is how the sovereign backing of those projects fundamentally alters the traditional risk profile of real estate development. Well, in a normal commercial real estate venture, the developer faces massive structural risks right off the bat. Will the city approve the zoning? Can they secure financing at a reasonable interest rate?
Will anyone actually buy or rent when it's done in 5 years?
Exactly. Those variables make early stage real estate highly speculative.
Because if the developer runs out of money halfway through, you are literally just left holding an empty concrete shell.
Right. But look at the mechanics of a giga project like NEOM. The sovereign wealth fund is driving the initiative. The zoning is guaranteed from day one.
Wow, okay.
The infrastructure is deeply integrated into a national macroeconomic plan. The cost of capital is heavily subsidized or just directly injected.
So it's a completely different ballgame.
It really is. While it doesn't eliminate risk entirely, nothing does, it essentially creates a brand new asset subclass. You are investing in real estate that has the developmental stability of a government infrastructure bond mixed with the upside of a brand new economic sector.
Wait. I need to push back on that a little bit. Because if I hear government-backed giga project building a futuristic city, my immediate thought is that this game is only for institutional players.
You think you're priced out?
Yeah. I mean, I can't just go buy a residential block in a multi-billion-dollar logistics hub. If a listener wants exposure to that deep-rooted stability, how do they actually get their capital into the project?
That is a great point. The mechanism the source highlights for the individual investor is the REIT, the Real Estate Investment Trust.
Okay, so the REIT is the bridge.
Exactly. A REIT acts as a bridge. It pools capital from thousands of individual investors to purchase, develop, or manage these large-scale income-producing properties.
Oh, they see.
So an individual can just buy shares in a Tadawul-listed REIT, which in turn actually holds the commercial leases, the logistics centers, or the residential developments within these sovereign-backed zones.
But how does the risk profile hold up if a massive project stalls? Like, if I own shares in a REIT that is heavily concentrated in a new development and the timeline gets pushed back by 5 years, isn't my capital just trapped?
Well, that is the crucial distinction between a development REIT and an income-producing REIT.
Oh, okay. Break that down.
The source emphasizes looking for vehicles that have guaranteed offtake agreements or are investing in phased developments. Instead of waiting 10 years for an entire city to be built from scratch, a smartly managed REIT might own the logistics and warehousing hubs that are currently being used to actually build the city.
Oh, wow. That's clever.
Right. They are generating rental yield today from the construction and supply chain activities. They pay out dividends to the shareholders now while still capturing the long-term capital appreciation of the area.
So you aren't taking on the raw construction risk. You are monetizing the ongoing economic activity.
Exactly.
Okay, so the REIT gives us our deep-rooted, slow-growing fruit trees. But, you know, an orchard needs variety. We need some fast-growing crops to generate quicker yields.
Yes, we do.
And the text moves from real estate into equities, specifically looking at the Tadawul, the Saudi Stock Exchange.
Mm. Equities represent your aggressive growth engine. When you buy a share of SABIC or Aramco or just a broad index ETF, you are buying a fractional share of the future earnings of those huge corporations.
Right.
Now, in the short term, the valuations will fluctuate wildly based on global supply chains or commodity prices. But over that 5 to 10 year horizon we established earlier, equities historically outpace inflation and provide the highest absolute returns.
The source also brings up Sukuk as the counterweight to those equities. And I want to unpack the mechanics here.
Sure.
Because Sukuk are often just loosely defined as Islamic bonds, which frankly really doesn't explain how they actually function.
No, it's a terrible definition.
Right. If a standard bond pays a fixed interest rate and Islamic finance strictly prohibits the charging of interest, how does an investor actually generate a return from a Sukuk?
The underlying mechanism is completely different from traditional debt. When you buy a conventional bond, you are lending money to an entity, and they promise to pay you back with interest. You're a creditor.
Right.
When you buy a Sukuk, your capital is pooled into a special purpose vehicle, an SPV. And that SPV actually buys a tangible asset.
Like what kind of asset?
It might be a toll road, a hospital, or even a fleet of aircraft. The SPV then leases that asset back to the government or the corporation.
Okay, so you aren't receiving an interest payment. you are receiving a proportional share of the rental income generated by an actual physical asset that you partially own.
Exactly. And when the sukuk matures, the issuer buys the asset back from the SPV at a pre-agreed price, returning your principal.
That's brilliant.
It provides the exact same fixed income stability and capital preservation as a bond, but it is backed by real, tangible economic activity rather than just a promise to repay debt.
Wow.
And the text points out that government-backed sukuk are incredibly popular right now as a stabilizing anchor for portfolios, largely because the default risk is virtually zero.
So they're the sturdy, weather-resistant trees in your orchard.
Yes. They won't grow to the sky like an aggressive tech stock, but they won't blow over in a storm either.
Now, the guide also touches on the Public Investment Fund, the PIF. This is obviously the engine behind the tech and tourism sectors.
Absolutely.
The source notes that gaining access to PIF-backed funds is a way to align a portfolio directly with the national growth strategy.
Yeah.
You are essentially co-investing alongside the sovereign wealth fund.
Which is a very powerful strategic alignment.
Mm.
Though the text does caution that these avenues often require higher minimum capital commitments and longer lockup periods than your highly liquid public equities.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. The source introduces gold and precious metals into this asset mix.
Yeah.
Now, sticking with our orchard analogy, if equities are fast-growing crops and real estate and sukuk are deep-rooted trees,
right.
Gold is just a shiny rock sitting in the dirt.
It is.
I mean, it doesn't produce fruit, it doesn't pay a dividend, it doesn't generate rent. From a purely mechanical standpoint, it contradicts the entire premise of compound growth. So why dedicate any portfolio space at all to a non-productive asset?
Because an orchard needs a perimeter fence.
Okay, explain that.
Gold is not a growth engine, it is a defensive shield. The text highlights its utility purely as a store of value and a hedge against systemic shocks.
Like inflation.
Exactly. Let's look at the mechanics of currency. If inflation spikes globally, fiat currencies lose their purchasing power. A dollar or a rial simply buys fewer goods. Gold, historically, absorbs that inflation. Its price in fiat currency goes up, preserving your purchasing power.
So it's basically an insurance policy.
Yes. It acts as an uncorrelated asset. When equities crash due to, say, a geopolitical crisis, panic drives capital into safe havens. Gold spikes.
Right.
It doesn't compound on its own, but having a 5 or 10% allocation allows you to rebalance during a crisis. You can sell the gold when it is high to buy the equities when they are distressed, effectively protecting the overall momentum of your portfolio.
Okay, so we have a lot of different crops available now. The real estate REITs, equities, sukuk, PIF funds, gold.
A very full menu.
But knowing what to plant doesn't tell you how to design the layout. The source transitions into a framework for building what they call your personal algorithm, matching these specific assets to a listener's unique constraints and values.
And the first constraint they mention is always ethical and religious alignment. The text notes that for many investors in the region, Sharia compliance is the absolute non-negotiable foundation.
Which makes total sense.
Yeah, and that immediately filters the universe of available assets. It means utilizing Islamic REITs, asset-backed sukuk, and mutual funds that strictly screen out conventional banking, highly leveraged companies, or prohibited industries.
Right.
The framework is built from the ground up to ensure the wealth generation aligns with your personal values.
Now, the second constraint is the tax leak we discussed at the very beginning of the show.
Yes, the bucket with the hole in it.
Exactly. The Saudi environment offers zero personal income tax, but the moment you diversify globally, like buying a U.S. domiciled index fund, for example, you run into cross-border friction.
And that friction usually comes in the form of foreign withholding taxes. If a U.S. company pays a dividend to a foreign investor, the U.S. government automatically withholds up to 30% of that dividend before it ever crosses the border.
You never even see the money.
Never. And that breaks the compounding engine. The source makes it extremely clear that structuring your investments to navigate those tax treaties is just as important as picking the right stocks.
Which brings us to the core of this personal algorithm, the time horizon matrix. This is where we match the asset to the ticking clock.
This raises an important question, though. How does your need for liquidity dictate your risk capacity?
Right.
The source divides this into three distinct buckets. The first is the 5 to 10 year horizon.
Which is short term in the context of our discussion.
Exactly. If you need this capital in, say, 7 years for a child's education or a property down payment, you cannot afford to lock it into an illiquid private equity fund. The text recommends leaning heavily into liquid ETFs, publicly traded REITs, and shorter duration Sukuk.
Assets you can sell on a Tuesday and actually have the cash in your account by Thursday.
Precisely that level of liquidity. You need the growth to outpace inflation, but you need the exit door to remain wide open.
Okay, then we move to the 10 to 20 year bucket.
Here, you have the runway to actually absorb economic cycles. A market crash in year 3 just doesn't matter if you don't need the money until year 15.
Right, you just ride it out.
Yeah. The source suggests shifting the weight toward aggressive global equities for maximum compounding while utilizing Sukuk to dampen the volatility. You can also start introducing private equity here, capturing what we call the illiquidity premium.
Oh, explain that premium. Why do I get paid more for giving up access to my own money?
Because you are removing the behavioral risk for the fund manager.
How so?
Well, if a manager knows you cannot withdraw your funds for 10 years, they can take a big swing. They can invest in a distressed company, spend 5 years restructuring it, and sell it in year 7 for a massive profit.
Oh, I see.
They cannot do that if they have to keep massive amounts of cash on hand to satisfy daily withdrawal requests from panicky investors. You are compensated with much higher returns in exchange for locking your capital away.
Makes perfect sense. And then the final bucket is the 20-plus year horizon. Generational wealth or real long-term retirement planning?
This is where you fully align with the macroeconomic shifts. This is the capital you deploy into the giga projects and PIF-backed funds.
Right, because a project the scale of NEOM requires decades to reach maturity.
Exactly. If you match your 25-year time horizon with a 25-year infrastructure cycle, you are perfectly positioned to ride the entire wave of value creation from the ground floor up, relying on decades of tax-efficient compounding.
So what does this all mean? We have the assets, we have the timelines, we have the tax considerations. The final piece of the puzzle laid out in the guide is execution.
The execute. Specifically, the framework utilized by the Osul Gamma platform. And the core tenet of their execution strategy is diversification. Asset class diversification, which we covered, but also geographical diversification.
Yes.
And I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Please do.
If the premise of this entire deep dive is that Vision 2030 is creating an unparalleled economic boom, and the local growth potential is astronomical, and the tax environment is pristine, why would I take a single rile out of the country?
That's a fair question.
Like, why wouldn't a rational investor just put 100% of their portfolio into local Tadawul stocks and Saudi real estate?
It is an incredibly tempting proposition when the local momentum is that strong. But the source is adamant about the danger of geographical concentration.
Even in a booming economy.
Especially then. No matter how robust a single economy is, tying your entire net worth, your primary income, your real estate, and your investment portfolio to a single geography leaves you incredibly vulnerable to regional systemic shocks.
Oh, a fluctuation in global energy prices, a regional geopolitical event, or a localized supply chain breakdown could impact all of your assets simultaneously.
So you are building this beautiful orchard, but if a localized drought hits that specific valley, you lose everything.
Exactly. A truly resilient portfolio captures the explosive, concentrated growth of the local Vision 2030 projects, but anchors itself by participating in the broad, diversified stability of the global economy.
Right.
You own the Saudi infrastructure, but you also own fractional shares of healthcare companies in Europe and tech companies in the U.S.
But navigating that global exposure brings us right back to the tax leak.
The withholding taxes.
Right. How does the Osul Gamma framework mechanically solve that 30% withholding tax issue when buying those global assets? The source mentions tax-efficient wrappers and offshore investment bonds. How do those actually work?
Think of the wrapper as a greenhouse built over your offshore investments. Mechanically, instead of you as an individual Saudi resident buying a U.S. index fund directly, you open a life insurance bond domiciled in a tax-neutral jurisdiction, somewhere like the Isle of Man or Luxembourg.
Right.
You fund the bond, and the bond itself purchases the global equities.
Wait, so legally the insurance company owns the asset, not me?
Yes, exactly. And because of the specific tax treaties between that neutral jurisdiction and the U.S. or Europe, the withholding taxes on the dividends are drastically reduced or in some cases eliminated entirely.
That is wild.
It really is. The dividends pour into the bond structure, completely shielded from the friction of international tax laws, and they immediately reinvest. The compounding engine runs at maximum efficiency.
So you maintain full control over the underlying investment choices, but the legal structure of the wrapper protects the capital from leaking out across borders.
Precisely.
That is a brilliant mechanical solution, and it really highlights why execution is so complex.
Mm-hmm.
But the text concludes with a point that strips away all the complex offshore bonds and SPVs.
Yeah, it brings it all back home.
It argues that the ultimate goal of this entire structured approach isn't just about maximizing the spreadsheet. It is about enforcing behavioral discipline.
Well, the math of long-term investing is actually quite simple. The failure point is almost always human psychology.
Always.
We panic during market corrections. We get greedy and chase viral trends. We basically sabotage our own compounding.
We run around chasing the falling leaves.
Exactly. But by setting up a structured, diversified portfolio, utilizing wrappers and professional frameworks, you automate the discipline. The text lists the tangible quality of life benefits. You experience drastically reduced stress because you no longer care what the market does on a Tuesday.
Right.
You pay lower fees because you aren't constantly trading in and out of positions. And your investments become goal-based. You aren't just trying to beat a benchmark. You are funding a specific future reality for your family.
To synthesize everything we've explored today, success in this landscape is a formula of extreme clarity, immense patience, and structural defense. It is about understanding your exact time horizon and matching it with the right tools. From the deep-rooted sovereign stability of local REITs and Sukuk to the aggressive tax-shielded growth of global equities, it is about building an architecture that protects your wealth from both external taxes and internal panic.
And it requires accepting that true wealth building is methodical. It is the slow, deliberate process of tending the orchard.
For you listening, this isn't just theory. This is the blueprint for your financial autonomy. It is about creating a secure, compounding legacy that outlasts any single market panic or economic cycle.
You know, there's one final implication here that extends far beyond individual portfolios.
What's that?
We've spent the entire session analyzing the mechanics of wealth accumulation. But if we zoom out and look at the macro picture of Vision 2030, when an entire generation of a nation shifts its collective mindset from seeking short-term speculative wins to becoming long-term structural stakeholders in their own country's infrastructure, how does that fundamentally change the psychological and cultural fabric of the society itself? When millions of citizens are literally invested in the 20-year success of their nation's transformation, that shared economic alignment becomes an incredibly powerful unifying force.
Wow. That is a profound perspective to leave on. The shift from speculator to stakeholder changes absolutely everything. Thank you for joining us on this exploration today. Keep questioning the mechanics behind the headlines, keep exploring your options, and the next time you feel that visceral urge to chase a quick viral financial win, pause and ask yourself, are you just chasing leaves in the wind, or are you ready to water the orchard?